You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking National League East with MLB.com's NL East beat reporters. We are just about a week from the non-waiver trade deadline, so we've got a lot of trade talk. We're talking about the philosophical approach to the deadline with the Braves and Manny Benuelos and Mike Fultonevich. Getting a Giancarlo Stanton update when we talk Marlins, as well as some trade talk and a look at what the 2016 Marlins might look like. Talking that very strange Michael Kadire situation when we talk Mets, and also checking in on Michael Conforto and other ways they might fix the offense. Take a look at the Phillies, we'll be talking Aaron Nola, Jonathan Papelbon, and Cole Hamels. And we'll take a look at the Nationals' bullpen, Joe Ross, and doing some injury updates. Though the news continues, at least to seem to be basically positive on Steven Strasburg, how close is he to being back in the rotation?
Well, I would say another few weeks because he's yet to throw on the mound. He's throwing on flat ground, which is a good sign. He doesn't have any pain in his oblique. So that's a great sign. So I would say in a few weeks. And then obviously he has to have the rehab assignment. So it's going to be at least a month before we see him in a major league game.
So that means there's an open rotation spot. Joe Ross gets that start in the short term. Is he the most likely guy to hold that down for a while?
No question about it. I mean, he's impressed Matt Williams in the front office. I mean, I've said it already that with Joe Ross around, they're not going to re-sign Doug Sister, and I think they're not going to sign Jordan Zimmermann either. So I think Joe Ross is definitely going to be in that rotation for good by next year.
What does he need to show them in the short term, both to hold on to a job now and to prove that he should be one of the guys next year?
Do what he did in his first stint, go deep in games. I mean, in 2 to 3 starts, he went 8 innings and another one, 7 2/3. So that's impressive. And I think he's already ahead of what you call guys like A.J. Cole. It's really hard to believe that he's moved up that quickly over a guy like that. So that's what he has to do the rest of the season, I think.
Yeah, Ross is a really interesting guy to me because coming into the year, he was certainly well-regarded. It wasn't like he was off the radar, but you know, he was not a top 100 MLB.com prospect. He was number 96 in Baseball America. He was a guy who was getting noticed but not really blowing people up. And I have to think if you redid those rankings now, he would be a lot higher on everybody's charts. And I have to think, assuming he doesn't lose his rookie eligibility, he'll be a lot higher this winter. What has he done in the Nationals organization to go from interesting guy with some ability to really exciting guy knocking on the door of a big league rotation?
I think, you know, he can get out of trouble quickly. I think also, again, like I said earlier, he can go deep in games. And I think he has you know, fastball that goes, you know, over 94 miles an hour. So I think that's been the key, the big difference. And also, you know, when he gets out of games, you can tell he wants to complete the game. But, you know, he's a rookie and Matt Williams wants to be careful with him. So I think they really like his makeup as well.
Let's talk bullpen, because we can't seem to do one of these without talking bullpen. Drew Storen has been very, very good, but they still seem a little thin in the bullpen. Blake Treinen was just sent down.
Correct.
Where are they at as far as getting closer to having all of that sorted out, figuring out who does what, and figuring out who the pieces of their best bullpen should be?
Well, I think it is getting sorted out a little bit because in the last 3 or 4 games, Casey Jansen has been an eighth inning guy. And he's in his last 3-4 outings, it's been 4 shutout innings and like 6 strikeouts. So he's been impressive lately. I think as of right now, we're going to see him as the eighth inning guy. We're going to see Aaron Barrett as a seventh inning guy. Now, since Aaron Barrett's been back from the disabled list, Aaron Barrett has pitched really well. I know the ERA is still a high, but since he's been back, he's been pitching very well. So I think it's settled right now, and but I have to cross my fingers because the bullpen outside of Drew Storen has not been good.
Yeah, and you led into my next question, which is in three appearances since coming back, Aaron Barrett has been very good. He's faced eight batters and struck four of them out, and that's an awfully good start. What kind of opportunity is there for him? Is there an opening for him to really sort of reclaim a big late-inning role in this bullpen?
Well, I don't think it's reclaim. I just think it's a matter of health with him. And Matt Williams, I'm going to tell you right now, since day one of last year, he's always believed in Aaron Barrett. He's never given up on Aaron Barrett. It reminds me, the way he treats Aaron Barrett is the way Matt Williams treats Danny Espinosa. He's never given up on him. And he's decided, hey, I'm going to give you every chance I can to be successful, which he's done.
One thing that really stands out with Barrett, last year he walked 20 guys in 40 innings. This year, you know, early in the year when his overall numbers weren't so good, his walks were way down. What's the difference there with him controlling the walks this year?
I just think it's mechanics. Again, like with Strasburg, he's trying to fix his mechanics, and they have been fixed talking to Steve McCaddy. And I think that's been the big difference. It's just a matter of mechanical things, not leaving his shoulder open, you know, when he throws. So I think that's been the big difference this year.
We've talked a good bit about what they might do externally, and it does seem like a bullpen guy or a bench bat would be the most natural fit. As the deadline approaches, we're now just a little more than a week away. What do you anticipate their priorities will be? And it's hard to say what gets done because you never know what's really available. But what do you think the priorities will be for the Nationals between now and Friday the 31st?
I still say they need bullpen help. Now, what's interesting here is that they called up Abel De Los Santos yesterday. So that kind of tells me, well, are they going to go after bullpen guy? But I still say yes, they still are. Because you know what? I think they need what you call a blowaway, a reliever who can blow hitters away. And outside of Storm, I don't think they have that, to be honest with you. So I could see them going after a reliever. I mean, everyone's still talking about Tyler Clippard. But you know what? Knowing the relationship between the Nationals and Oakland A's, I would have to think that the Nationals have to give up some prospects to get Clippard back. In terms of a hitter, you know what? I've been praising the bench. You know that. And I don't know if they need bench help. I just think that they need their regulars back, like Worth, Rendon, Zimmerman. And I think that's the biggest need right now for them. I don't think they really need a Ben Zobrist right now, because I think the bench has done a great job, to be honest.
And that does kind of lead me into how I wanted to take us home here. We're going to do 3 or 4 minutes of injury updates. first of all, Anthony Rendon, it seems like that's going well. How far away is he?
I would say it was in a week. There's no way that I see him coming back this week. I mean, he's admitted he's out of shape. So he's got to get in shape. I think he'll be back at second base before you know it.
And he does go back to second base when he comes back?
Yes, I do. Unless they make a trade, he goes back to second base.
Ryan Zimmerman, another guy who is back to playing games. Fair to guess he might be a while, or would he be a guy who might have a pretty quick rehab?
I think another guy will be pretty quickly, about a week. You know, he has to, so far, running the bases has been okay. But, you know, he's okay. He's going to be all right. We'll see him sooner than we think.
What's the confidence level that he's not going to feel effects of that injury when he comes back? Because that's a nasty injury. That's the thing that really, it really takes away your base, which, as you know, is a pretty major problem as a hitter.
Well, he has a padding, you know, in the shoe and on his foot. So hopefully that will, you know, protect the foot in some way. It's hard to say how it's going to be long term, but I think he's going to be all right. I mean, there's no way this guy is a 209 hitter. I think when it's said and done, with no pain, I think he's going to be driving in runs for this team.
Number three on the list, Jason Worth. He's a guy who's missed a lot of time, maybe needs some at-bats.
Oh, no question about it. I mean, he told me he's going to take a week or two and to be back in the major leagues. So I think we'll see him I would say within a week or two. And I think he's going to make a difference because of his high on-base percentage.
Yeah, he'd be a huge get for them to bring back. And then finally, Denard Span was the one guy that hopes would be quick as it was. Is that still looking like that's going to be pretty close to the minimum?
Yes, hopefully. He took some cortisone shots, and it's made a difference. He's already running on a treadmill. He has yet to swing a bat, but hopefully that will start this week. And, you know, hopefully he can get back and be their leadoff hitter. He's the best they've ever had.
Do they maybe manage him carefully when he comes back, maybe give him some proactive days off to sort of prevent this stuff from flaring up again?
Matthew, they have to because, first of all, they said that his core is weak. And that's part of the problem, too. His core is still weak and is going to take a full offseason for his abdominals to really get better. So it's going to be a while. Yes, he's going to need some days off in order to be strong. So there's no question about it. Matt Williams has to treat him with care. No questions.
I can't lie, on a week-to-week basis, the Mets podcast is probably the one I look forward to the most because it is the easiest prep. It is, we always have something to talk about. And now, so tell me if I have any of this wrong, because it seems like that's often how we do this. Michael Kadire has a health condition, I don't know if you exactly call it an injury at this point, has a health condition where the only thing that's really going to get it better is rest. He's playing very sparingly, if at all. He's playing poorly when he plays, and he's not going on the disabled list. Is that correct?
That's 100% correct, and you know, saying it out loud like that just sort of highlights how ludicrous the situation has become. You know, the only thing I'd quibble with is in the very sparing amount of time he's played, he's actually has been productive the past couple weeks. He's hitting a couple of home runs. Granted, one of them was sort of a garbage time homer. But, you know, for all of May and June and most of July when he did absolutely nothing at the plate, he's actually been a little better lately. But what does that get you when you're playing, you know, taking essentially 8 plate appearances a week, something like that? I don't know why they didn't just put him on the disabled list 3 weeks ago at this point. They could have done it around the All-Star break. He really would have only missed about a week's worth of games. Instead, you've got this situation where you've got purportedly one of your best hitters who can't play. He's taking up a roster spot. They lost a series to the Washington Nationals, 3 games, essentially playing 24 on 25, which is never what you want to do. And it's just a weird situation for everyone around. Every time I think Michael Kadire is about to go on the disabled list, he appears as a pinch hitter in the 7th inning of a game that, you know, a couple of them that they were going to lose anyway. So it's definitely a touchy day-by-day situation. It's definitely a bizarre situation. And it's gotten to the point where they kind of have to take action one way or the other and do it pretty soon.
The argument you sometimes hear, particularly with a key player, a guy, I don't know if you call Kadire a star, but certainly an important part of this lineup when he's right, the argument you often hear against DLing a guy is if it's a really central guy, you'd rather play short for 10 days than do without a core guy for 5 days too long. If you think he's getting back in a week and a half, then you just make it work because you don't want to do without him any days you don't have to. But I don't think there's, tell me if I'm wrong, I don't think there's any indication that he's suddenly going to be right, that if they give him 2 weeks, after a week, suddenly he'll be all right and they'll be wastefully putting him on. It seems to me, if I'm reading this right, that every day of rest is a valuable day of rest. So if it's not that, and again, I hear you saying you don't really know exactly what thought process is, what's the official thought process? I mean, what's the sort of company line as to why they don't just go ahead and do this?
Well, the company line is just that, you know, what you just described is they think this is a guy who can help them. Now, whether you agree with that or not, I would lean towards the other side because apart from the small bits of production that he's had the past couple of weeks, he obviously has not had a good season. It would be a much more interesting decision in my mind if he was the Michael Kadire that we've come to know over the past decade, even into the 30s Michael Kadire, where he's not carrying an offense, but he's also not doing a lot of things wrong. You know, if he had a 850, 900 OPS like he usually does, you could make much more of an argument for keeping him on the roster, having that as a dynamic bat off the bench, as a guy who can maybe start one or two times a week. But yeah, you know, the Mets have pretty much come out and said this is not going to get better without an extended period of rest, and yet in the same breath, they have not given him an extended period of rest. So the only logical explanation for doing it the way that they've done it is they think he's more valuable in the sparing at-bats that he's given them than he would be, you know, fully rested after two, three, four, however many weeks it would take, coming back and becoming an everyday player again. I don't agree with that. I think, you know, you have the offense being what it is. Michael Gaudier is not the savior right now. I think he has a much better chance of being some sort of savior if you have him at even 80, 90% as opposed to, what is he now, 30%, 40%? If you take it from a pure playing time perspective, that's essentially where he's at. So, again, it's probably something they should have done 3 weeks ago. They made a decision at the time, and they've continually made decisions along the way to play it out as they have. And it sort of put them in this little hole, in this weird limbo situation where you've got people calling for Michael Conforto, the top prospect on the farm. You've got people calling for anyone other than Michael Gaudier at this point. You've got Gaudier doing twice daily press conferences now saying, I don't really know what's going on either. It's just a bizarre situation all around, and it's one that, you know, the Mets have sort of put themselves in with their inaction.
Let's say everything else is the same, but Conforto has 500 at-bats above A-ball instead of double-A.
Yeah, he'd be so here already.
Would Gaudier be on the DL right now?
Yeah, I think absolutely he would, and I think that is a huge part of the hesitation is, what are our alternatives? There's really nothing in AAA. Daryl Siciliani is hurt. Kirk Nieuwenhuis is already up in the majors. You know, the name Travis Tyrone has been tossed around, but he's a raw prospect in himself. There's really just not a lot they can dip into. They've obviously looked at trades, but haven't pulled the trigger on anything yet. So short of that, you're looking at Conforto or bust, basically. You know, they could call someone up from AAA and have Kirk Nieuwenhuis and Juan Lagares and Curtis Granderson be your regular outfield, but they've tried that and it hasn't necessarily worked out great. I think that's sort of the hesitation is, you know, they don't know what they can get out of Michael Conforto. My opinion is they should just go ahead and try, and if he falls flat on his face, he falls flat on his face, and you send it back down. I think they're getting to that point now, but yeah, this is a guy who essentially has 50 games in his life above A-ball. It's hard to predict what he can give you. I think everyone knows he's not going to be the savior right now. He's more of a high floor than a high ceiling guy, even ultimately down the line. But it's getting to the point where if you're getting these diminishing returns from Michael Gaudier, you have to try something. And if that's your only bullet, why not shoot it now? Why not when you're three games out of first place and fighting for a wild card as well?
This may be just the sort of thing that happens when it's a New York team and New York media and a New York team with a clear and obvious need. But the Mets have gotten mentioned with some pretty interesting potential trade names. Jay Bruce, Carlos Gomez, guys who could really be potentially a significant upgrade. Do you think those kinds of names have any possibility at all, or is that really just kind of wish casting?
Well, it's a little bit of wish casting, and the reason why I say that is because they make a lot of sense. I think the Mets would be a much improved team if you brought an outfielder like that on board, or even if you brought an infielder like a Ben Zobrist, which is probably not going to happen, but a player of that caliber, a veteran with power, who you can stick in your lineup 5-6 days a week, can make a huge difference for an offense that's not hitting. The problem is you have to look at what the Mets have available to trade. They're not giving up any of their big pitchers, which is fine. I don't blame them on that. They're not giving up Michael Conforto, obviously, because that's someone who can help you, if not now, as soon as this season. And, you know, one of their other top prospects, a shortstop, Ahmed Rosario, is someone they see as a very high-ceiling guy down the line, and they don't look very willing to part with him. So take all that out of the equation. What do you have left? You've got sort of this group of middling, you know, not necessarily low ceiling, but definitely flawed prospects. The Brandon Nimmos of the world, the Gavin Cecchinis of the world, the Matt Reynolds of the world, guys who are getting close to the big leagues, if not knocking on the door, who don't necessarily knock your socks off if you're a a talent evaluator. So what are you getting in return for that? Probably a rental. So then you have to start looking at, you know, a Gerardo Parra, a guy who's going to be a free agent. And the Mets historically, Sandy Alderson historically, has not been willing to give up anything of value, really, for a guy he can't control. It was a huge leap for this front office to sign Michael Kadire in the first place, knowing they had to give up a draft pick to acquire him. That's something they had been very unwilling to do. It was something that they sort of had to gulp and swallow and do it. This just isn't really a risk-taking front office in that sense. So they're really hamstrung in what they can do. I'm not saying they're not going to make a trade, but for people looking for that blockbuster that's going to change the face of this offense in one fell swoop, I just don't see it in the next 2 weeks.
So what do they do? I mean, this team is in the hunt. I mean, there's a piece on Sports on Earth this week that essentially laid out that this frustration is understandable. It's one thing if a team struggles. It's another thing if a team is in position and doesn't capitalize on that opportunity. And it kind of feels like that's what's going on here. So given this opportunity, what, if anything, do the Mets do? And maybe more importantly, if they don't do anything, how do they go back to their fans this winter and sell that? How do they sell inaction to the fan base if it is, in fact, inaction between now and July 31st?
Yeah, and you know what? From a pure baseball perspective, there's definitely some merit to doing nothing. And I can't believe I'm saying this out loud for at least a part of me. But this is a team that with their pitching, even if you factor in an injury or two in subsequent years, they're set up pretty well. You know, you'd like to have more offensive pieces that you can build around, but when you've got that rotation of Jacob deGrom and Matt Harvey, who once his command comes back, and I fully expect it will, should get better. You've got Noah Syndergaard. You've got, you know, once he gets healthy, Steven Matz. That's quite the core to build around. So it does make sense if this is a team that's not going to invest heavily money-wise in the roster to just sort of go status quo. And while your offense is going to get a little older, you can supplement at the margins, get better, and reload. But this team has a heck of an opportunity right now. I mean, the three games against the Nationals were really a microcosm for the season. I mean, the team that they're chasing in Washington has is more injury, more affected by injuries than the Mets have been. It's a huge opportunity because that's a team that on paper is definitely better than the Mets, but they haven't pulled away from the Mets. In some ways, it might be easier to catch them than to catch the Pirates and the Cubs and the Giants and these teams in the wild card race where you're facing multiple competitors in that arena. So how they would sell inaction to the fans would be, you know, just what I said, which is we're really set up really nicely for the future here. The problem is they've been saying that for the past 3 or 4 years, and that's a hard spin job if you're the PR team and you're trying to do that. I think they have to do something here before the trade deadline. I don't think it's going to be a big splash. I think, you know, the play is to improve in the margins, and I think, you know, whether that's a Gerardo Parra or a Ben Zobrist or someone who makes you better on a daily basis without necessarily sacrificing any significant part of the future, that's what they're looking to do. Now, it's a lot easier to be said, it's a lot easier to say than to do, especially when you consider how many teams out there are looking at guys like that, how much competition they're going to have on the trade market, how many teams still feel they're in this playoff race. But yeah, it's a hard sell. They've put themselves in a tough situation, and spending a little more money would probably help. But it also wouldn't help to a great extent at this point, just given the issues they have with their roster up and down.
Mark, this team has been active not just all season, but really dating back to the end of last season. I realize that because of their position, it's very hard to predict what they will do actual transaction-wise between now and next Friday. But philosophically, what do you expect them? What's the strategy you think as they approach July 31st?
I think that you're looking at them having the option to move a lot of these veterans that are on one-year deals, so to where you're not going to get the significant return where you might have had you had the Jason Grilley still in place. They were talking to teams about packaging Jason Grilley and Jim Johnson. They would have probably gotten a decent return. I'm not saying it would have been blockbuster or anything like that, but it would have been stronger than any return that they're going to get for the Jim Johnson, A.J. Brzezinski, Kelly Johnson, Juan Uribe, those guys that, you know, they may end up dealing. either between now and Friday, or, you know, those guys could also go sometime in August. Now, the question is, will there be a team that jumps out and says, here, we want Cameron Maybin, and this is, we're going to give you a value to work to where the Braves would pull the trigger? Because would the Braves be willing to trade Cameron Maybin this month? Yes. Do I expect them to get the value that they're looking for? I don't get the sense they've at least heard that yet or feel that they're going to get that. That may be something that they end up doing in the off season, which at that point in time they'll have a better feel of whether they truly do want to move them, because they'll have a better feel of where Malik Smith and Jose Peraza are as potential center fielders next year.
Where do you think they see themselves on the success cycle? And what I mean by that is, we've talked a lot about 2017 as a target. How do they view 2016? Does this organization feel like maybe they might get where they're going a year sooner than everybody thought, or is this still kind of a long game that they're playing?
I think that hinges a lot on what, if they're able to get a power bat, and what kind of power bat they're able to put in this lineup next year. You've seen some indications that they could have a very solid rotation next year with Shelby Miller leading it if Matt Whistler continues to progress like he has. Earlier this week when he faced the Dodgers, we saw him. Here's a kid who relies heavily on his slider, that swing and miss pitch. He did not have it for the first two innings, yet the only damage, you know, he was able to get through the first four innings pretty much unscathed. The fifth inning, it did bite him. He left a few fastballs up and was hurt. But what I'm getting at is he's a kid who's already shown that maybe even at his best, he can survive at the big league level and be successful. I like what you've seen from him. Alex Wood, it'll be interesting to see where he goes the rest of this year. Last year, he was at a similar point heading into late July and went on a tear there towards the end. But you've got those guys, and then obviously, and with all these arms, they've either got guys that are going to fill this rotation or at some point this winter may be used to help improve that offense, because with the surplus of arms they have, there's no doubt that some of these guys are going to be dealt eventually.
The odds are getting pretty long. I mean, they've been pretty long for a little while now. Is it maybe in the long run a good thing that they're, you know, a couple games under instead of a couple games over and a little closer to making a big swing? Or do you think they wouldn't have really gotten too aggressive even if they were a little closer?
Yeah, I really don't think so. You know, when you and I talked about this a couple weeks ago, I said, look, at least if it lost some games now, this will prevent them from being conflicted going into the trade deadline. And a couple hours later, they won the first of two straight against the Nationals and then won a couple against the Phillies, a couple more against the Brewers. But they went to Coors Field, and since then, things that they've been kind of where we've expected them to be, where they're back in that position. Now we're close enough to July 31st to where I don't think their mindset would change. Now the question is, let's go back to a week ago or a little bit more than a week ago when they were at 500 in Milwaukee. And since then, they've gone on this longer losing streak, and things have evened out. But, you know, would they have been conflicted? It would have been hard to make some of these moves had they stayed right there at 500 and only been three games out. It would be hard to justify to your fan base. But what I can tell you is, even during that stretch, they were still talking to teams about Jason Grilli, Jim Johnson, Kelly Johnson, A.J. Brzezinski, some of these veterans, because they understand who they are. And they had a good feeling of where they might be by the end of this month.
How do you think, I mean, look, you, I'm not that far out of town, but you deal a lot, you talk a lot to fans, you have Twitter and you get that interaction. There was a lot of unrest, it seemed, over the winter. People looked at a team that came close and saw it being blown up and said, what in the world are they doing? Do you get the impression that as some of these young players have developed, as this team has been maybe better than people expected, do you get the impression that this front office has kind of bought itself some goodwill with the fan base, that maybe the view of where this organization is different from 6 or even 3 months ago?
I would say it's certainly a lot different than it was in November and December. Spring training provided them a little bit of a glimpse of what this team might be. Then obviously you had the Craig Kimbrel deal on the the eve of the season, which, you know, a lot of fans weren't happy about that, but you look at the return that they've already gotten from that trade, which, you know, made perfect sense and still will continue to provide dividends for the next few years to get Whistler and Maven and just to be able to build off of what they had already gone. Yeah, I think the fans, the fan who keeps up with the minor league system understands the value of prospects. I don't think that they've ever really had much of a problem with what the team's done during the offseason. The fan who may not pay as close attention but is being updated on how much different the prospect list looks now as compared to the end of last season. I think that you can't help but realize that, hey, look, this club's in a lot better shape than it was in October when you were looking at Peraza and then obviously Lucas Sims and Jason Hirsch being your top prospects. We've gotten to a point where, look, it's far too early to give up on Lucas Sims. He still has potential to have a very bright future. But we've gotten to a point where you really don't even hear anyone talk about Jason Hirsch. And a few months ago, he would have been their third or fourth best prospect. Now you're looking, you know, closer, in my opinion, probably closer to somewhere in that 15 to 20 range. They've just added that many arms. What they do need to do, their job is far from done. You know, we continue to talk about adding some power, but the easiest way that they believe to do that is to you know, gather all these arms, see which ones fit, which ones you want to keep, and then deal the others to try to get value in the other aspects of the game where they are currently weak. And we have to look at that catcher's position going towards next year too, because while A.J. Pierzynski, it's been great to have him around this year, and he's probably exceeded expectations and just the simple fact of being able to play every day. You know, they have to address whether, you know, they want to continue to give Christian Bethencourt another chance next year, or do you go and chase a Matt Wieters during the offseason.
One guy that they, brought in fairly quietly over the winter, really, who's been very exciting, is Manny Banuelos. It already sounds like maybe he's coming up against some limits. What's the plan for him as they go forward?
You know, I'm expecting to hear a little bit more with that here within the next few hours. He's scheduled to pitch again. But here we are. He's nearing 100 innings. Last year he pitched 76 in the third innings with the Yankees coming back from Tommy John surgery. Right now you're looking at a guy who they don't really want him to throw much more than 120 to 130 innings. So if he does have one more – if he does make one more start this weekend, I would expect that to be his last start. And then move him to the bullpen for the remainder of the season where you can monitor his innings. But I think that they've seen enough of him this year to have hope that he would fill that fourth or fifth spot in their rotation at the beginning of next year. The kid has a great changeup. He's not the same guy that wowed the Yankees during spring training in 2011. With an electric fastball, with Mariano Rivera saying he's one of the best pitching prospects he's seen. But at the same time, he has proven that he can pitch it at 90-91 with that good changeup.
If he moves out of the rotation, is the natural move and is what happens that Fultonevich goes back to starting again?
You know, they want Fultonevich. They understand. They look at Mike Fultonevich and they say, hey, look, if you just want to tag him right now, what his future is, the way his mannerisms, his repertoire, his approach to the mound, they realize he fits that seventh, eighth, or ninth inning guy in the bullpen. They understand that. But before, you know, putting him in that position for an extended period, they wanted him to go down to the minor league level, go back to Triple-A Gwinnett, and just work on on his power stuff. Shy away from the slider, which has proven to be too inconsistent for him, especially at the big league level. Try to develop maybe a split finger. Now, we're in the very early stages of that. So that's one of those things. If he starts to show some progress in that realm, I think that you'd want to keep him at Gwinnett for an extended period. You've got Williams Perez coming off the disabled list. He would be easier to fit into that rotation spot that Banuelos has currently held for the last couple of weeks. So I think that would be your immediate fix while allowing Fultonevich to continue to either prove to himself or to the to the organization, that he can be that guy who can rely on that fastball, live with a split finger, and just get away from that slider, which he has never gotten a consistent feel for in terms of command or location.
Joe, there was a Giancarlo Stanton update yesterday. It seemed fairly routine, but also good news. What's the latest with Stanton?
Yeah, I mean, clear to take some swings, you know, some dry swings, just get the bat going, test that wrist hand and make sure, you know, the scar and the incision are all healed and everything. And from there, he'll take it to eventually hitting off the tee, the flips, and, you know, maybe 10 days or so, he could be back in the lineup, which, you know, for a team that hasn't had a lot go right, that would be a very welcome sight. But first things first, just, you know, get him going, get through this. It's not an injury that requires a lot of strengthening or big rehab. It would be a matter of you feeling strong, then get the timing back and a little bit of the pain tolerance that you can play with some discomfort in that hand. Wrist, which he's going to have, which is normal.
So that's a little strange for me to hear, just for the combination of a team that their hopes are certainly fading and an injury that's a pretty major injury for a power hitter. I mean, wrists are just a big deal. Is there any thought that maybe he doesn't come back till he's pain-free, or is that just too long to do? I just wonder, like, if you worry about a guy developing bad habits, it's interesting to hear you say that. What's the thought process there that you might come back and play with pain?
It's because of the break, Matthew. It's the hamate bone, which is that little hook-shaped thing that really isn't attached or does much. You know, it just kind of is there, just frays and goes away. So it's not like there were multiple fractures or a fracture that healed per se. They just take that little hook-shaped thing out and clean it up. And all indications are it's fairly routine. And a lot of players have had it. Some have come back more quickly than others, just from some of the research. And some of the people I've talked to know a lot more about it than I do. They say, you know, they are saying 4 to 6 weeks. They say 6 weeks is about right, and I'm kind of in that boat, mainly for what you say, power hitter, and there's no power hitter like this guy, Matthew. And if one thing we learned from StatCast is he mashes a baseball 115-plus miles an hour more than anybody on the planet. And you clearly want him to be healthy. But that said, like I was saying, it's not like, you know, bone coming together and healing. It's just a matter of just, you know, getting that timing down, make sure that the incision's fine, and then just go from there. And that's kind of the nature of this injury. If it was more of what I was just talking about, it, then I'd be a lot more concerned whether, you know, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, or, you know, or more necessary.
You wrote fairly recently about how this was a really pivotal trip for the Marlins. It was a chance for them to gain a little ground, maybe make it a little harder for the front office to part with some pieces. As we speak right now, they have yet to win a game on this trip. Where does that leave them as July 31st approaches?
Yeah, I think it leaves them, you know, clearly, you know, they're coming out of the break, you know, riding some momentum, winning 3 or 4 from Cincinnati. You know, Philadelphia seemed like winnable series. Arizona then on to San Diego. That they're just kind of wanting to see if this team can play a little bit like they envisioned. They kind of know, you know, even though they're saying what they are, where they are in the standings, and that playoffs are remote, but they want to see progress. And they still, like we talked about before, believe in that core. But where it's leading to is there's going to be multiple moves, and I don't think that's going to shock anyone. And, you know, I think even if they, you know, won 6 or 7, there were going to be multiple moves, and some of the guys leaving town are the guys that probably would have been leaving anyway, and that could be Matt Latos, is the guy they're actively shopping, and Dan Haran, who has done a really, really good job, and you might want to strike while it's hot to get and move him by the end of the month as well, and in hopes that by then Nicolino and Urania or whoever else they feel could kind of round out the rotation will be in line to kind of carry them the rest of the way.
How extensive do you think the moves will be? And we've talked a lot about Latos and Haran. Those seem like the obvious guys, only because they've got real value. But, you know, there are some other pieces that you have to think they'd at least get calls about. Do you expect this to be you know, move a couple of pieces who aren't going to be there next year, or do you expect it to be any more extensive than that?
Yeah, I think it could. I think it could go anywhere to 3, 4, 5. I mean, especially if it keeps heading in the wrong direction by their assessment, they may start looking at, you know, kind of make up. They know where they are. They, you know, Martin Prado is a real pro, and in his comments, you're hearing him saying that he's not worried. He just want to kind of help this team get back on stride and inform. Well, that's one reason why they're probably not going to move this guy. He's what they want. You know, they know what they have up the middle. They know what they have in the outfield. They love their catcher in Real Muto. Everyone else, Matthew's in play. I mean, obviously Jose's not, but, you know, they're going to be, you know, looking at strengthening pitching, starting pitching, hopefully controllable. And whether it's this deadline or not, you know, Michael Morse has not panned out. The fact that they're not even playing him, you know, when he's healthy, shows, you know, what they feel about where he is right now. And I'm sure they're trying to move him as well. And, you know, that, you know, it's going to probably be their offseason project to get a first baseman that will be more of a thumper that they feel could offer that. I'm not even going to say protection, because Stanton posts numbers regardless of who's around him, but just production. You know, they just need to get, you know, a lot more production for moments like this when he's not in the lineup. You just can't have the offenses dry up and have no, you know, you're having Echevarria hitting third one day, you got Prado hitting cleanup one day. You know, that's not the way this team was built. So I'm anticipating anywhere 4 or 5, whether Kohler gets involved in the deal. I wouldn't be shocked. I think Cishet could be moved. But, you know, I think that you could see 4 or 5 trades by the end of this month.
How do they view 2016? I mean, this team is not, I mean, things can change. There's still plenty of season left. But this team is not, you know, even playing 500 ball. It's not like they're on the fringes. They are well under 500 to the point where,
right,
you know, it would take a pretty significant improvement to be a contender next year, the kind of improvement they thought they were going to be this year. I guess, you know, what I'm getting at is, do they view this as a team that should contend in 2016, or do they view that maybe they have a little sledding and maybe this is still another year or two away to really get this right and be where they want to be?
Yeah, those are all fair, because it clearly wasn't the step forward they thought they were getting. And, you know, the minor league system isn't exactly a strength right now either. I mean, they moved, what, 11 to 13 prospect types or guys that had just gone, either were in the minors or up a year or so, just to get some of these core players we've just talked about. So, you know, they're a couple of drafts away from getting back. They probably need to, you know, like I said, move somebody they're probably not the most comfortable with to kind of get some organizational depth. But, so Matthew, I honestly feel they think that they have a very good basis for a team. They need to get a little bit better starting pitching, meaning, you know, not just guys that are 4 or 5s, but guys are 3s and 2s to circle around with Jose. And then they'll take it from there. I mean, we see how unpredictable this season has been for so many teams. You know, Boston didn't think they'd be where they are. Houston was hoping, and they're where they are, you know, when no one saw that coming. So, you know, you kind of have to take it, you know, at where you are at the moment, and just feel that the pieces are in place. But there is a clear, to me, lack of this very clear organizational direction, because they've known some clubhouse guys they need to move, yet they haven't been moved yet. And, you know, they've been very patient, and you know, they're sticking with a manager who's a general manager. And, you know, that may be their biggest offseason decision, is where's the direction coming from in the dugout? Is it going to be DJ again, or are they going to get him back where he was the best and from an organizational standpoint, and then go get somebody that's going to fit what they're trying to get to? So, I wish I had more clarity, because I haven't seen a ton of clarity. So I think they're just banking that this existing core is going to carry them pretty far in the next year or two, and it's going to have to, otherwise they're going to do yet another dismantling, and we know how those things always go.
One last thing. The Derek Cosart situation remains odd. I mean, this condition keeps coming back, and, you know, if anybody's ever dealt with vertigo knows that if you haven't, it's easy to dismiss, and if you've ever had it at all, it's really, really nasty stuff. So where are they as far as figuring out what's going on with him and getting him back to where he can perform again?
Yeah, that's a great, great question. There is concern. You know, there is concern. You see a neurologist, they're determining whether it's just the vertigo, or is it more, is it, you know, but you know, it's been a couple of times now. You know, from what I understand, he was on the mound the other night, and he just wasn't feeling good, and knew immediately it wasn't dehydration, and you know, it's hard enough to play this sport with all your senses and to be off, you know, like that in your head. I think they need some answers before they worry about fixing, you know, mechanics or whatever it is on the mound. But it is a situation where doctors are looking at him the last couple of days, and they're trying to get to, indeed, is it just purely vertigo? Did the antibiotics knock all of it out? Is it, you know, is this a mild case, or is this something more troublesome? But, you know, definitely something the next couple of weeks, whether he pitches again this year or not, may not be as important as if he's okay or not, to kind of let him become the player they hope he will be. But first, they got to make sure that everything's okay with him. And right now, neurologists are kind of determining what that is.
Todd, I'm not sure we're going to know what to do with this particular 10 minutes, because I think we're going to have some optimism here. as we speak, it is mere hours until Aaron Nola's Major League debut, which means all of us can project upon him whatever we want. And can make him into whatever Hall of Fame pitcher that we choose for him to be. If we are being fair and honest, what should be expected of this right-hander?
Well, long-term, if you believe most scouts that have seen this guy pitch in the minor leagues, they will tell you that he projects as a solid number three type of starter. I know, a 6-7 inning type guy. You know, he's not Max Scherzer. You know, he's not Steven Strasburg coming into the big leagues. He might not even be Cole Hamels, but he's a good, solid rotation type of guy that you can, I don't want to say build a rotation around, but certainly you can build a rotation with, if that makes any sense. But quite frankly, the Phillies obviously need a guy like that, a guy that you can throw out there and most days is going to give you a chance to win a ball game. So, you know, he doesn't have overpowering stuff. So I think there's been so much hype about Aaron Nola. I think it makes some sense to maybe temper those expectations a little bit. But on the other hand, that doesn't mean he's not going to be a quality big leaguer for a very long time. I think he's got a stands an excellent chance of doing that. But, you know, yeah, like I said, he's not Matt Harvey. He's not Max Scherzer. He's not projected to be those types of guys. But that doesn't mean he's not going to be a very good big league pitcher for a long time. I think he will be.
It's worth noting that sometimes those guys do turn out to be more than that, you know, and I come to this with a particular bias. You know, I spent a lot of time around the Cardinals, but, you know, that was kind of the book on Lance Lynn. To a lesser extent, that was kind of the book on Michael Wacha, that they were high-floor, low-ceiling guys. Sometimes those high-floor guys develop a high ceiling. Do the Phillies have any inclination, or just people you've talked to, evaluators, as to what it would take for him to sort of be more than that good quality innings eating durable mid rotation guy?
Well, you know, he throws in the low 90s. He can get it up there every once in a while. I think the big thing, if he does become more than what most of the evaluators project him to be, I think it is going to be because he has incredible command of his pitches. This is a guy who does not walk a lot of guys. He's ahead. He works ahead in the count most of the times. And if he can continue, if he can do that at the big league level, be a strike thrower, attack hitters, you know, don't walk a lot of guys, don't give up those free passes. You know, I think he might be able to be a little bit better than a lot of people think he will be.
Okay, enough of that fun stuff. Jonathan Appelbaum wants out. He takes every opportunity he gets to say he wants out. They want him out, too. I mean, they don't want him gone, but they would like to make a move. Is he the surest guy to be somewhere else on August 1st?
I think so. If I had to put my paycheck on it, if I had to pick a Phillies player that's most likely to be traded, I would have to put it on Jonathan Papelbon. I just think clearly the time has come to do this. You can't keep him and try to trade him in the off season. I mean, you could try to do that for sure, but why do that? You know, I think at this point, if you can get something of some value for him and not have to eat all the contract
I think it would behoove the Phillies certainly to do that. You know, he doesn't want to be here. Now, what's ironic about it is as vocal as he has been about wanting out of Philadelphia, he really has not been much of a problem in the clubhouse in terms of being, you know, people always talk about, is this guy a good guy, bad guy? He doesn't want to be in Philly. He's made it clear. He's told the fans, hey, I love to be the villain, so boo me if you want. But he hasn't been a disruptive force in that clubhouse. So now whether that would remain true remains to be seen if he's here on August 1st. But I think, you know, they feel some pressure to do it. They want to get it done. But if the best offer is we're not going to trade you anybody decent and you're going to have to pay all of his contract, I guess maybe they keep him. But I do think that they're going to find somebody at the last hour to come forth and make a deal to acquire Jonathan Papelbon.
Let's give the Phillies the benefit of the doubt and say that the relative difficulty they've had making deals is not on them, that they haven't been ridiculously demanding, and that in fact they're being reasonably demanding, that they should get a lot for Cole Hamels, they should get a good return for Jonathan Papelbon, they should get a good return for anybody they move, because they don't need to get out from under the money. What they need to do is restock the organization. Let's grant that and say this is not a matter of them just being difficult. Even if you grant that, when you talk about Papelbon, and even if you grant that he's been fine in the clubhouse, to some extent he has to be a headache at this point. All of which is a very long preface for my question is it time for them to adjust what they're asking on him in particular, given that no matter what, he's probably not going to get you a franchise-changing talent. And at some point, the headache is enough. And at some point, you want, if you're developing an organization, you want guys who want to be there. You want to be building this culture of guys who want to win as Phillies. Is it approaching time? Is it already time? Have they already made the decision that maybe you back off a little and you just get this done because it's got to get done?
Yeah, I think there has been a little adjustment. You know, I think as you get closer and closer to the deadline, the Phillies' expectations become more realistic, and I think the other teams' expectations become more realistic in terms of, you know, what you can do to get this player. Now, I think personally, if a team came up to the Phillies and said, listen, we'll give you this double-A guy, you know, he could be okay, but we'll take on the rest of his contract, no problem, I think the Phillies got to do it. I think you just got to move on from him at this point. You know, it depends who you talk to, and I've written this before, and I believe we talked about this before. I think what you have a lot of is you have people inside the Phillies organization saying, you know, we're not asking for that much, but we're really getting lowballed here. And then you have people on the other side saying, you cannot believe what these guys think that they should get for Jonathan Papelbon and Cole Hamels. And what I think it is a lot of this is playing out in the media. The Phillies are trying to put pressure on other teams. Other teams are certainly trying to put pressure on the Phillies to get rid of these guys. And I think if a team wants a player from the Phillies enough and the Phillies want to trade that guy enough, they're going to have some honest discussion in these last couple weeks, less than 2 weeks, to make something happen.
And that kind of leads into my next question. I would give credit if I remember who wrote it, but, you know, as all of us in 2015, we consume a zillion tweets and blog posts and stories everywhere, and it can be hard to remember. But the idea was floated, and I apologize to whoever's idea I'm quoting here, that perhaps the Phillies might look at this Hamels situation and look at their front office situation and say, well, there's a pretty good chance we're going to have a different-looking front office. We're certainly going to have the team president, even if he's partially on board now, even if McPhail is partly on board now, he's not fully ingrained yet. There's a decent chance they'll have a new general manager. There's a pretty good chance they'll have a new manager, and that's not the guy who makes the decisions, but he's part of the process. Given all of that, if the deal that's going to make your franchise is Hamels, do you wait until all of that is in place? Is there now some thought that even after we've talked about this for months and months, that maybe they just say, look, we're going to make sure we do this right, and we're going to do a Hamels deal in the offseason when we've got our front office in place?
I think there's certainly a possibility. I think there's certainly a possibility of that. You know, what's interesting to me is, you know, you have Andy McPhail, who's got to live with the trade beyond this year. He's not calling the final shot. Pat Gillick, you know, he's calling the final shots. He's stepping down at the end of the season. So you have kind of a weird sort of thing going on. And what I think might happen, I think there's a possibility they could hold Hamels until the offseason if they don't truly like what they've got. You know, if Pat Gillick is making the final call, and he is, I think there's definitely the possibility that they could go, you know what, I just don't feel good about this deal. Let's just hold on to him. We don't need to shed the payroll, and let's let Andy deal with it in the off season. You know, that would not surprise me at all. You know, but certainly the whole Gillick, McPhail, Ruben Amaro sort of, who's calling the shots here? Is it? There's got to be some. It's just a weird situation, quite frankly, in my opinion. You have, like I said, you have Andy McPhail, who's going to be in charge, not calling the shots. He's got to live with whatever trade is made right now. And Pat Gillick, who is calling the shots, is kind of walking away after the offseason. Now, he will remain, you know, he's got part ownership. He will remain involved to some degree. But it's a very strange sort of setup right now. And you do wonder how that is going to affect the trades, you know, in the next couple of weeks. And then, you know, the trades that could be made in August, you know, over the next 6 weeks or so.
Now, to play devil's advocate in one way to all of the arguments that I just made, if Cole Hamels is healthy, and everybody swears that he is, and he's been as ineffective as he's been the last two starts, it's sort of natural to wonder, does he have one foot out the door? Is he, understandably, I don't mean to be running him down or anything, it may not even be conscious, but if he has one foot out the door, does that operate in the other direction and maybe increase the urgency to go ahead and get a deal done if this guy is going to be maybe not all the way there for the next 2 months? You know, two starts probably don't hurt his value. If he's not fully effective for 2 months, that could affect his value.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think if he would finish, if he's really thinking about this trade deadline on, again, he says he's not. But what athlete has ever said, boy, I am super rattled by these trade discussions. I can't think of a player, baseball player, off the top of my head that's been like, I just can't go out there and compete. You know, I'm a mess right now. I'm a mental mess. You don't really hear that happen too much. So he says he's not bothered by it. But if he is bothered by it and he is struggling and then he's still here on August 1st and he's super disappointed. I mean, we saw this with Roy Halladay in July of 2009 when the Phillies got Cliff Lee over Halladay. Halladay's first few starts after that trade deadline when he didn't get traded to the Phillies were pretty bad, and he acknowledged later, you know, I was just really out of it. I was depressed. I was bummed out. I didn't have the focus I normally had, and it's human nature to let it affect you. So, yeah, if Cole does not come out this weekend in Chicago and pitch well, he's not traded, and he kind of continues to struggle down the stretch, that would really hurt his value. So I think what the Phillies are really hoping for is that Cole goes out there this weekend against the Cubs at Wrigley Field, who, by the way, are one of the teams that have expressed some interest in him. And I think he hopes that he goes out there and he just dials it up and just dominates for 7 or 8 innings. And all these teams are going to go, okay, this guy's still a stud. We got to make this happen.
This is MLB.com Extras. Thanks, everybody, for listening.